Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
This is Walk-In's Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you are welcome. You know the drill. Please subscribe, rate, comment, share, reach out, tell your friends, send smoke signals, whatever. We love your feedback and we want to hear from you. This week on the podcast, I'm excited to welcome Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist at New York University's Stern School of Business. He received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in 1992 and taught for 16 years in the Department of Psychology at the University of Virginia. Haidt's research examines the intuitive foundations of morality and how morality varies across cultures, including the cultures of progressive, conservatives, and libertarians. His goal is to help people understand each other, live and work near each other, and even learn from each other despite their moral differences. Haidt is the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, and of the New York Times bestsellers, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, and The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. I'm with Jonathan Haidt, everyone. Welcome to Walk-In's Welcome. I think you definitely hold the record as maybe the most cited other person on my podcast that everyone references.
Well, I do kind of feel like, you know, like my time has come. I mean, like I staked out certain positions a long time ago, and it, you know, the academic world is kind of like I bought Tesla and Bitcoin a long time ago. Now, unfortunately, in my stock market investing, if I just did the opposite of everything I've ever done, I would be a much richer man.
You wouldn't be caught in the culture wars.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't want to be here? My first question was just jokingly going to be what's it like to be a prophet? Because, like you said, you were a light years ahead of a lot of these trends we're seeing all across the board. How are you feeling today?
Yeah, so it is really, it's a really strange and funny time. So, you know, aside from all the normal awfulness and doom and gloom that we're all talking about and thinking about, it's an incredibly interesting time to be a social scientist. It's like there's this, you know, this decade or these recent years, and then there's the 1960s, and then there's the 1930s. Like those are the three times that really stand out as super exciting times to be a social scientist, and where the things we're doing are really needed and valuable because so many people and governments are making such terrible mistakes, and whole institutions and schools and companies are making terrible mistakes in how they're responding to the pressures of the moment. So that's exciting. And I guess your question about being a prophet, because what I study is moral psychology, which is kind of the operating system of society. It's not self-interest. It's not greed. It's really much more about relationships and judgments and who can we trust and who's on our team. And so it's actually really gratifying. In a way, it's really gratifying that things are blowing up and going completely insane, because it's kind of like, oh yeah, moral psychology, really, you know, it really is important. This is really exciting. Mm-hmm. So that's what it's like.
And do you feel optimistic or pessimistic? I feel like this is a question I get a lot from people, myself, but also a lot of the people in my community had this question for you specifically.
Sure. Yeah. So long run optimistic, but that's more with my head than my heart. And that's because books like Steven Pinker's been talking about this for a while. The decline of violence is astonishing. And no matter how bad things get, it's nothing like it was in the 60s when there were bombs going off every week, more than once a week. And then also Matt Ridley's book, The Rational Optimist. And I think you probably have a lot of libertarians on your show. And I think they're right that in the long run, human creativity community is extraordinary, and the bigger problems get, the more people work on them. So, you know, 30 years from now, you'd have to be foolish to bet, if you could bet even money, you'd be foolish to bet that 30 years from now, things will be worse. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the long run, I'm optimistic. But all the trends that Greg Lukianoff and I described in the Coddling the American Mind, they're all getting worse. Mm-hmm. And we're actually right now, this week, we're writing an afterword where we're going to do a slight revision of the book, catching up. And it's astonishing the way, you know, mental health has gotten worse, mm-hmm. the politicization has gotten worse, the overprotection has gotten worse. So I don't think things are going to really get a lot better in the next few years. It might take 5 or 10 for us to work through this period of craziness and then restructure. There's great work by Peter Turchin, a mathematical historian, actually. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He talks about cycles of history. Every 60 years or so, you get this big change, like a big crack up. And he predicted 10 years ago that one was coming around 2020, he said. He said that's what the cycles show. So short run, not optimistic, but we have to remember that history does move, not in perfect cycles, but we're likely to come through this better off.
I hope so. I have a hard time seeing how that process happens, I guess, where some of the things that seem to be infecting a lot of our institutions are insidious, and that it almost creates just a complete disintegration.
Yes. So let's talk about the case that things don't get better, or at least that it takes a long, long time. So in the 60s, you know, there was the youth rebellion movement and, you know, changes in norms around sex and violence. And, you know, the left really even flirted with terrorism. I mean, that was like a sexy thing to do, was to blow things up. And that kind of quickly faded away in the early 70s.
Okay.
And people got tired of it. Matt Ridley says that, because he was just younger than that vanguard generation, he says by the time he got to college, we just thought that the hippies were ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, there are pendulum swings in fashion and what's cool. And if that's all this was, then yeah, I would think that the 60s would be a good analogy. Obviously, a lot of great stuff came out of the 60s and social change. But the extremity, including the terrorism, actual, you know, killings and beatings. So you might think that could happen now, but there are two reasons to think that it'll be different and that these problems will be much more long-lasting. The first is what you just basically said, which is this isn't just like, you know, some extremist getting extreme. This is really the takeover of institutions. Mm-hmm. And it's most visible, I don't know what your listeners are like, but, you know, in my world, I never meet anybody on the right other than anti-Trump conservatives.
Right.
Everyone's on the left. All the institutions are on the left. Nonprofits are almost all on the left. You know, journalism, the arts, museums.
I mean, I'm in LA.
Advertising.
So.
Okay. Oh, yeah. All right. Fine. So you're on the right. You're on the left coast, and I'm on a small island off the coast of North America called Manhattan. So given, you know, the sort of like the wokeness was already rising, and this is what Greg Lukianoff first noticed in the universities in 2014, that something new and strange had been birthed. And, you know, at first it was in the universities and people said, oh, come on, this is just college students being college students. And when they get out into the real world, they're not going to be able to ask for trigger warnings and safe spaces. They're going to have to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, I don't know. We'll find out. And and Gen Z started graduating around 2018. And it wasn't just them arriving. There were other social trends. But the corporate world began getting woke, you know, after Trump was elected, and a huge rise in employee activism. And after George Floyd was killed, a lot of these institutions, probably every private school in Manhattan at least, and it's probably the same in LA and the Bay Area, every progressive private school committed to anti-racism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, of course, we're all against racism, but as you and your listeners surely know, anti-racism means Ibram Kendi's, you know, Manichaean, us versus them. If you're not an anti-racist, you're a racist, which means that almost everybody's a racist and, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
So, now that that's baked in to the policies, procedures, the employee resource groups, the HR policies, it's going to be very hard. That stuff can't just evaporate in a couple of years. So that is a worrisome trend.
It's interesting because I've been following your work, listening. I wonder, do you think this process that you observed, does it feel like it happened faster? Like things kind of went mainstream faster than you would have expected.
Yes. By orders of magnitude. Orders of magnitude. I mean, and so here's where we get to the second reason to think that this time may be different and much more long lasting. And that is social media. But I don't just want to be the guy who comes on the show and says, oh, social media is terrible. I want to be the guy who comes on your show and says, okay, you've been hearing that it's terrible. Let me explain exactly the mechanism by which it is so terrible. And I didn't know this until I teamed up with Tobias Rose Stockwell, who I'd met through a few mutual friends. And he actually, you know, he worked in the tech industry. He knows all the people in the social media industry. And he really knows the guts of it.
Mm.
And I, as a social psychologist who's studying both cultural trends and teenagers, and that's all going haywire beginning around 2014, 2015. But I also study politics, and I've been writing on right-wing populism and authoritarianism, and that all began going haywire around 2015 mm-hmm. in populism in Europe, in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote an article about it just before the Brexit vote, and then I had to like change it to like update the fact that, wow, you know, now this populist movement took over. And we'll see in November what happens in the USA. And then, of course, Trump won unexpectedly. So by 2017, once Trump was in office and then Charlottesville happened, all this craziness, it was like, what is happening to the universe? And it really felt like there was a disturbance in the force.
Mm.
And, you know, I love metaphors. And the metaphor that I kept coming back to was something like about how, you know, there are 25 or so physical constants that you learn in your physics class, like the gravitational constant and the mass of an electron and a proton and all sorts of things like that. And that means that they are constant everywhere in our universe. They are constant, but there could be an infinite number of other universes where the gravitational constant is different.
Mm-hmm.
And so the metaphor I kept coming back to was like something happened around 2014
mm-hmm.
in which like God reached in and he doubled the gravitational constant just for fun. Let's just see what happens. So he doubles it, and then like birds start falling out of the sky and bridges are collapsing. He's there laughing like, oh, wow, you know, 14 billion years of just the same old stuff, and now I get to see some new stuff. This is great.
I think like it was that collider. Yeah.
Excuse me? Oh,
I'm
oh,
convinced
my God.
That would collider.
I forgot about that. When was that?
That was around then. I'm like, you guys, we shouldn't be doing this.
Holy cow. We got to check this out. Wait, while we're talking, I got to Google. I can't think that well. But I will look at that after we get off because, I will look at it because it is a great joke and I will try to use it.
It's a great joke.
But I don't believe that it was that. Yeah.
Because they started smashing atoms in that collider over in Europe, and then things started going haywire. And I remember joking about how I'm like, I don't think we should be doing this, guys.
Yeah,
you know, we might not know what doors we're going to open. And I've been saying the same thing. It feels like we sliding doored into another reality.
Yeah. No, that is a fantastic metaphor, and I am going to steal it. I'll credit you. But here's, I think, and actually, okay, superconducting supercollider. What happens when you take all the people in the world and smash them all together in an environment that incentivizes hostility? So in a sense, we did get a superconducting supercollider known as Twitter and then other social media platforms. But here's the really cool thing I learned from Tobias. So social media really begins around 2004. Right around then, you get MySpace and Friendster mm-hmm. and the Facebook. But Facebook only jumps out in front around 2008.
Mm-hmm.
But all during this time, it's not toxic. It's just, here are all my friends, and here are links to, you know, bands that I like, and here, you know, so here's me. Look at me. Okay, that, you know, it's narcissist promoting, but it's not toxic. It doesn't destroy democracies. And it's not a superconducting supercollider. It's just a way to broadcast yourself. The big change happens in 2009. This is the pivotal event. Facebook adds the like button and Twitter copies it. Twitter adds the retweet button and Facebook copies it with the share function. And as the engineers said, one of the engineers who worked on the retweet button, after a couple of weeks seeing how it was being used, he said, oh my God, it's as though we gave a loaded gun to a 3-year-old. And so that's when that's like there's like a, what do they call it, a singularity or a, there's some phase
right.
change, a phase change that happens in this fabric of human society between 2009 and 2012. Because as we adapt to this, well, what happens? Now that Facebook and Twitter have all this engagement data, before then, they didn't have a way to, you know, know engagement other than if you actually went to a site. But now, click, 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 we're giving them vast amounts of information so that they can now use algorithms to curate our feed, mm-hmm. which makes us more engaged. And then our content is fed depending on what other people like. So social media gets much more engaging between 2009 and 2012. And that's the exact period when American teens and British teens, at least we have data on them, flood onto social media because they weren't on it every day before then.
Right.
And by 2012, they are. And there's a study I saw in Britain in 2008 or so, most teenage girls would go over to their friends' houses at least once a week. That was like a normal thing you did. After school, you might go to a friend's house.
Right.
And it was like 70 or 80% said yes to that. And in 2012 or 13, something like that, it dropped to 20%. So we're not socializing face-to-face anymore as much.
Right. I'd like to know when everyone got a smartphone too, because when did it become just ubiquitous to have a smartphone as a teenager? That certainly wasn't the case for me.
No,
it wasn't
right.
even the case for my oldest nephew, who he always talks about how his youngest brother, who's 8 years younger than him, got his first smartphone when he was 11. And he says, you know, I had to wait until I was 16 or 17. And so even he's about to be 21, and his experience versus his youngest brother's is vastly different.
You got it. That's right. That's exactly right. So I got a Palm Pilot back in 2002 or 2003, and it sucked. Like, you couldn't do anything. It was so slow. You couldn't do anything with it. And so the iPhone coming out in 2007 was a pivotal event.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the iPhone didn't cause the problem, but the iPhone was such an accelerant because it was a great smartphone. And I do believe from watching my own children that even though they can often do the same thing on a laptop and a smartphone, the touchscreen of the smartphone is much closer to Skinnerian conditioning. Like, you get the reinforcement. It's just more visceral and quick. So I think smartphones are more addictive. But it comes out in 2007, but it's expensive, and very few teens have one.
Right.
And they're not on social media every day. But, you know, then the price comes down, and then Samsung, I don't forget what year they come out with their phone. But by 2011, 2012, most teens have one.
Right.
And even though they're not supposed to be on social media platforms till they're 13, I don't know what year it was that most 11-year-olds have it, but when my son entered ninth grade when he entered sixth grade three years ago, he said, everyone has Instagram, and I didn't let him have it because I was doing the research on how bad this is for kids.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it was the iPhone, it was social media changing. And then just to finish the story about how the universe got messed up, by 2012, now everyone's so engaged, they don't go to the New York Times website anymore, not as much, because you're being sent so many articles by your friends from the New York Times. Why subscribe?
Right.
And so the mainstream media has to adapt to social media. And that was the other big step in making this a national phenomenon and basically warping the entire informational ecosystem. And now I am stunned, I'm horrified by the number of stories, not so much in the New York Times, but like on Fox News, the number of stories that are about a tweet.
Right.
And, you know, it can be, you know, if it's President, you know, Trump threatening nuclear war with Korea, okay, yeah, that's a newsworthy tweet. But if it's literally, you know, somebody objected to something someone said, and then someone tweets about it. This is not a news story.
This
is just daily life turned into a national, you know, anger fest. So that's what happened.
Yeah, there's so many intersecting. I'm fascinated to be living in this time because there's a lot of things that I was joking about that I wish I wasn't necessarily right about. When I was in London in Ireland, and they kept asking me, it was the year right after Brexit, and they were saying, do you think Trump will win? I was like, yeah,
oh,
I
wow.
do. Look what wow. happened here. And my friends always say, you said that he was going to win. And I was like, Kim Kardashian made $75 million last year. Culturally, that is where our values are.
Yeah.
It seemed crazy to me that he wouldn't win, just given that we love this kind of reality everyone out.
But wait, I would say it's more than that. We all have intuitions about how things work from before 2009. And if we were having this conversation before 2009, you could say what you just said and be like, yeah, you know, this is where people's values are. But everything changed between 2009 and 2012, and the laws of social physics are different. Mm. And that's why Kim Kardashian was able to do that, and that's why Trump was able to. Without Twitter and Instagram, they couldn't possibly have done those things. Trump couldn't possibly have won without Twitter. So we're living in a different reality. And I'm seeing this in business. I say this to anytime I talk to a business leader, I say, look, you've got these various challenges in your business, and you're going to respond using what you think is your common sense. But that was based on what you learned throughout your life, and it doesn't apply anymore. Or rather, a lot of our beliefs don't apply, but we don't know which ones.
So how does one navigate this new social construct? Mm-hmm.
So you really have to keep your eyes open and look at the repeating patterns. And so here's a repeating pattern. And I've gotten caught up in it too. You know, somebody tweets something, or there's a story. Let's say there's a story about a business. Take any business. Oh, what's happening on Jeopardy? That guy made a story. It's perfect. Yeah. You know what? Why don't you just summarize? Because I just saw a bit. Just summarize where we are on that story.
So as far as I understand, with the most updated information I have, there was a Jeopardy contestant who answered the word. One of the questions, the answer was he used gypsy, which technically I guess was correct, but was a slur. Anderson Cooper corrected him, and then he won three times in a row, and he used the okay symbol. He had previously done one, and then two when he won the second time, and then the third time.
Oh, he had done that hand symbol? Oh, yeah.
He had already said one, two, three, and then, but this is where that kind of concept of, have you heard of the concept of BlueAnon, which is basically the left-wing QAnon?
Yeah, right, the crazy
BlueAnon is a real thing, because in the absence of evidence, they will say things, and this is one of the tweets that was linked in an actual article, which is exactly what I thought of when you said, oh, it's one tweet, was one woman who said, this guy made this white supremacist gesture and we basically need him to apologize. But then someone said, no, context matters. He did one and two and then three. And then her response was, oh, that's a perfectly logical way to set yourself up for doing it's total conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Right,
basically
right.
saying, oh, he did this so he could make this white power gesture.
Right. It was crazy. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Right. Right. Now, if they did some research and they found out that he actually was involved in white power stuff, then it becomes at least worth saying. But without that, it's not worth saying.
No. But then 450 past contestants wrote an open letter on Medium.
Complete insanity. That's right. So, okay. Yes.
But
okay.
Let me read the first paragraph, because this is the problem with everything.
The problem with everything.
A recent contestant has caused concern among Jeopardy viewers for two separate occurrences, and we as former contestants feel the need to speak out against the messaging that these choices communicated, either intentionally or unintentionally,
by the contestant, Kelly
Donahue, and implicitly by association, the producers of Jeopardy. I'm like, here's the problem with everything. It's intentional or unintentional, doesn't matter what your intention was, and anyone who associates with you is also guilty.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
So it's straight back to the witch trials, where intention is irrelevant. All that matters is that I got sick. And if I got sick, you must be a witch.
Yeah.
And if someone defends me, then they're a witch. So this is exactly what Greg and I talk about in Chapter 5 of The Coddling the American Mind.
Mm-hmm.
This is our ancient tribal magical psychology. Humans have always lived in worlds full of demons and warlocks and angels and elves and nymphs and supernatural creatures. And the achievement of a kind of a more calm civil society where we don't kill each other and we don't blow up each other's homes was this temporary thing that we had for a few decades in the late 20th century. And, you know, I think we'll get it back, but we might not. And it would be because of Twitter. None of this could have happened, or, you know, none of this Jeopardy bullshit, none of it could have happened if not for social media platforms that maximize for engagement. But we were talking about, you asked, how do people navigate? So any leader of any organization, I talk to all kinds of people who are running organizations, and especially if it's a left-leaning or progressive organization, they're tearing their hair out. These are all people on the left, and even if they have sympathies on many of the issues, they're all fed up with wokeness because it makes it impossible to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
As one person said, you know, I thought we had a great culture, and then suddenly it's always a conflict because somebody said something, and the whole company has to be involved for weeks. It's so frustrating. And, you know, you can do that on campus. Like if a college campus descends into constant bickering, the college isn't going to shut down. But it, with the company, it will. I mean,
this
if you can't.
This seems like a feature, not a bug, though. This seems like a feature of wokeness, is that problematizing of everything so that you can't get anything done.
No, I don't think so, because I don't think that it's strategic. I don't think wokeness is strategic. I think it's an emergent phenomenon of intent of super social creatures who care more about their reputation than anything else, including money, put into a context in which their reputation is constantly quantified, and the costs of speaking up with common sense are so vast to your reputation and your social structures that people engage in all of these nutty, foolish, stupid, and destructive practices that add up to the paralysis of many of our most important institutions. But I don't think it's intentional, because there's no brain, there's no plan, there's no organization.
No, but there is an ideology of critical theory that kind of underpins a lot of this. So there is an ideology that drives it. Whether the average person knows that that's anything about critical theory, which I don't think they do. I think the average person is a good person who, like you said, cares about their reputation. But all of this stuff comes out of the stuff they learned in these schools about critical theory and white privilege and the deconstructing. And like you said, Ibram Kendi, the anti-racism, that's an ideology, isn't it?
Yes. No, you're right. You're right. That's a very good point. I just started reading Helen Pluckrow's Cynical Theories. And, you know, I got a PhD in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. I was there from 1987 to 1992 when I was back for a postdoc. So that was the last wave of political correctness. Mm. And, you know, the first one was the late 60s, early 70s, and then it comes back late 80s, early 90s, based a lot on, you know, Foucault and sort of a neo-Marxian stuff. So there have been three waves. And when I was in grad school, I tried several times to understand deconstruction. Mm-hmm. And all I can remember is the joke, what do you get when you cross a mafioso and a deconstructionist? Do you know this one?
No.
Oh, you get an offer you can't understand. And I really tried a couple times. I tried reading Foucault. I just couldn't get anything out of it. So I never figured. But I just started reading Helen Pluckrose, and she's really good. And
she's brilliant.
Know. Yeah. But here's the thing I got just from chapter one. Critical, I didn't realize this, critical literally means that the point is to criticize existing power structures in the hope of destroying them.
Exactly.
So I think you may be right that there is a sense in which you can say this was the strategy hatched long ago. Now, whether they thought that the method was to just make people fight all the time, I doubt it.
Right.
I don't think they thought, we're going to just make everybody, someday there will be this thing called social media and it will gum up the works of everything.
Right, right.
You know, because that would be like, you know, like saying, you know, someday they're going to invent a superbug so lethal it will kill everyone. Like, you know, because who is suffering the most? Progressive organizations are the most paralyzed. Any conservative organization is not paralyzed by this. But any, you know, Silicon Valley, why are a lot of these guys leaving the Bay Area and New York?
Right. You know,
there are a variety of reasons, including lower taxes. But I've heard from several people who have friends there saying, no, it's actually they can't find a school to send their kids to. The schools are all so woke.
My therapist today told me two things have happened in the past 24 hours that have me a little bit unsettled about the process of this process we're talking about. Because I have days where I'm like, we're fine. And then I have days where I feel deeply pessimistic. And I think it was Turchin. Is that
Peter Turchin, yeah.
I believe it was him who was talking about preference falsification and this thing that happened in communism.
Yeah, well, he might have mentioned it, but that actually goes back to, what's his name? Turkish-American political scientist at Chicago. I'll think of it in a moment.
Okay.
But whatever, preference falsification, right?
Right, and this process that happens when people are siloing their public persona and their private beliefs. And social media, obviously, is just made for this. And like you said, it's so hard to parse how much of this is just normal humans behaving the way humans would with gasoline thrown on top of it with the social media. And then you have these activists who push this stuff. And then we have bots who aggravate it. It seems like, and I was talking about this on a podcast yesterday, I feel I have thousands of millions of years of evolution that are being manipulated by these very smart algorithms and billions of dollars put into this stuff. And I'm this squishy little idiot in the middle of it. Yeah. I don't stand a chance.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, you and I don't know you, but I assume you and I are doing pretty well here, and the violence hasn't come yet. It could still come. You know, there are other parallels. You know, one parallel people often talk about is when the printing press was developed. Mm. Historians do seem to think that the two or three centuries of constant war in Europe and the split between Protestants and Catholics and the, you know, the rise of ideology and the French Revolution, all this stuff would not have been possible without printed,
interesting,
printed text. So, you know, that took a couple hundred years and the death of, you know, I don't know, a quarter of Europe or what, I don't know how much it was. And I don't think it's going to be that bad this time. I think that, you know, again, I have to just have faith based on historical experience that 20 or 30 years from now, things will be better. But right now, yeah, we are sick. Our society is sick. But we also have an immune system. We have defenses. And
we're likely to work it out.
We do have defenses. So for one thing, the great majority of people are really reasonable. Mm-hmm. Now, if it turned out, so, you know, I was just out front of my building, the NYU graduate students are on strike. And okay, you know, I'd love to know their grievances. I'd love to know what, you know, what it is. And so I came up to my office and I looked, and it's the usual ridiculous list of demands, including don't allow police or NYPD should not be allowed on the NYU campus. We can't let them into our buildings. Like, wait, this is a labor negotiation between you and NYU, and you want, instead of your $21 minimum wage, which you now have, you're insisting that during the pandemic, when NYU is really stretched, that you need a raise to $30 an hour to be a TA. So, you know, that on its face is incredibly excessive. But if that's all it was, I would say, you know, okay, this is a labor negotiation. But no, most of the demands are things like, and no one, oh, I have them here. It's unbelievable. It's like, it's all the stuff that students give on their list of 100 demands to the university president. So the game that was played out on university campuses beginning in 2014, 2015 by undergrads has now gone national. It's over in Europe. It's now the graduate students are doing this. But it's all stuff like that nobody shall use offensive words. And if they do, they will be punished for it. That's practically what they're saying. And of course, that, you know, that's illegal. Like, you know, and while you can't promise that people won't use insensitive words or that people will be punished for misgendering, things like that.
Right. The two stories. So one is I was in a 12-step meeting. I'm in recovery. And the speaker came in and they were giving a speech, but it all ended up being about how 78% of the rooms are white and we need to do better and work harder. Right. You're talking to a room of junkies, mind you.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was laughing because, you know, what is the population of America that's white? 76%. You know, so it's that's something right. like yeah. essentially well, you're fra- arguing yeah. that we need more addicts of color. You know, yeah. like, well, what this is
oh my God.
Ridiculous.
Oh my
on its
God, that's great.
Face.
That's great. Yeah.
So there's yeah. that, but I worry about that kind of. This is the last place you think a junkie who's kicking heroin cares about their white privilege, and this is yeah. the absolute no. last place this stuff should be. And I'm seeing it there. And I saw somebody tweeting about this, their experience with it. So it's. And then other people were sharing. And then my therapist was telling me that she was in Pilates with a teacher. And they live in a very small town in the Northeast. And the teacher was telling her, confiding in her, that she had to take a racism and math class for her elementary school. And that they're no longer allowed to correct Black children when they get the time wrong. They have to.
Oh my God!
They have to say that they have to be diplomatic about it, but they can't say no. That was wrong. They're
oh
not allowed
God.
To. And she was saying, you know, the teacher was saying, I feel very racist looking at a child of color and saying, "Oh, that little Black child can't be corrected because
right,
he's
exactly.
Black."
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And so, this is one of the patterns we're seeing over and over again is that. Reforms are recommended not based on any evidence or any psychological theory that they would work. Reforms are recommended that have no track record. No, I've never been able to find a school or a company that came out better or less racist or having more harmony or more inclusion. But they're recommended for sort of performative reasons as a way of expressing outrage at racism. And they often make things worse. We're
right.
seeing this over and over again. Trigger warnings, you know, the research shows trigger warnings generally don't do anything, but to the extent that they ever have statistically significant effects, they're negative. They actually make things worse. But, you know, the activists still demand or talk about trigger warnings. It's not that common, but they still do ask about that. And the example you just gave about teachers not wanting to correct Black kids. So I was talking to someone in the tech industry who said, you know, we're all afraid to give critical feedback to women and African Americans.
Yep, I've heard
this. Without critical feedback, how are they going to improve?
You can't.
So yeah, you know, we're all treating them with kid gloves, and then they're not, you know, they're not successful, and then, you know, of course you're called racist because they didn't succeed at the business. Now, I'm not saying there are no indignities and insults. I'm not saying there's no racism, but I'm saying that anti-racism generally makes things worse.
Right. I wrote a piece about the importance of not caring, because going back to this social media and how we can navigate it, I find that we've been, you know, it's human nature to care, but this again is gasoline poured on this already fundamental feeling people have about caring about every event, every global event. Yeah. Every life event that your friends have, every birthday, every single, you're supposed to care. And now you're not only that, you're supposed to have an opinion. And you talk so much about, you know, in The Righteous Mind in particular, what happens when politics become religion? There's something else that happened since 2015. And I thought maybe when Trump was gone, people would settle down, but it actually seems like they're still addicted to this feeling of self-righteousness.
Well, that's right. So Trump, you know, if you look at the graphs of lots of things, like in the stock market, for example, you look at graphs of lots of things and there's like a long trend, and then there's this big dip down where COVID happens, but then it comes right back up and the trend just continues. And it's the same thing for a lot of social indicators. Things, you know, rage was rising, outrage culture, political polarization, mental illness, all these things were rising. And then we get Trump, and there's this temporary, like, oh my God, it's completely insane, and it's, you know, but then he's gone, and it's just we're back to the baseline trend from before, or maybe worse. Maybe he might have a lasting effect. But, you know, Trump didn't cause the polarization. The polarization is what made it possible for a lunatic like him to be elected. So you said it's important to not care. Yes, that is an essential skill, but here's the problem. We are wired, or our minds are constantly trying to suss out the relevant information. And it's not like we're doing it rationally, like, oh, well, I can just discount for the fact that, you know, Twitter's not the real world. No, these are automatic processes based on whatever patterns were adaptive over the long period of human evolution in small groups. And so, you know, if one person says something to you, you can brush it off. But once it's three or four, you think, oh, my God, everyone must be thinking this. And somebody, I can't remember who to credit, but somebody told me the other day, like, you know, back like, you know, 30, 40 years ago, if you're running a company and you get 10 letters about your product, 10 angry letters about your product, you think, oh my God, there must be like, you know, 1,000 people who feel this way, who just didn't take the effort to write and put a stamp on it and say, oh my God, 10 letters. We better do something about this. But now if you get 1,000 angry tweets, what you should think is, oh my God, there must be 10 people who are angry about this.
Right.
So, you know, you have to flip it, and you have to really say, you know, 5 or 10 or even 1,000 people on Twitter, you know, isn't actually a thing. Or rather, it's going to seem like, you know, a Mack truck coming at you. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember, objects in Twitter are, you know, 1,000 times smaller than they seem.
Mm-hmm. It's strange. I feel like Twitter is not real life, but I also see, particularly since everybody's been locked up and not interfacing in real life and you know, person to person, that the behavior that was confined, and I asked the guy who wrote, he wrote all about the psychology of kind of online behavior, but I asked him, he was talking about why specifically we interact differently online than we do in real life.
Yeah.
And I asked him, do you think that will eventually reverse and people will start behaving like they do online in real life? And I see that more and more.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes, it's happening.
I do think Twitter is becoming real life.
Yeah.
You know, even like the Proud Boys and Antifa, all those little like, you know, cosplaying fights they have in the streets, those, they represent they're the physical manifestation of these kind of extreme fights we're seeing.
And what are they doing? And what are they doing while they're doing that? How many of them are taking a photo or having someone take a photo of
them?
And so this is part of why it warps us so badly, because when you are online, if you have a Twitter account or an Instagram account and you are creating content on a daily basis, you are living your life thinking about what am I going to post.
Right.
And this is what I've realized about myself. You know, I think I'm pretty civil on Twitter. I never get into Twitter wars. I try to always be polite, and that, you know, that's true. I mean, I study moral psychology, and I try not to be judgmental. I try to understand people. But I see that when I read something, my first thought is, oh, you know, how should I frame this for a tweet? And then the motives are either to make myself look smart or to get in a dig at, you know, whatever the opposition seems to be. And I realized I'm on sabbatical trying to write a book and I'm making no progress. I'm 4 months in, I've done almost nothing. And it's not that I'm a Twitter addict, but, you know, an hour a day, you know, because it sends you out to other stuff to read. So, you know, an hour or two a day, that adds up to a lot. And I realized I've got to get off, but I've got responsibilities to people. And I finally came up with a formula. So, okay. The news is about to, I'm going to read, here's my pinned tweet now. And I'm suggesting this as a strategy for people who feel like me, that this is just bad for them and bad for society. So here's what I wrote. I said, I believe that Twitter is bad for civilization, many people's mental health, and my sabbatical. So for the next few months, I'll try using it rarely, mostly to publicize events and praise people, books, and essays.
I read this morning.
Oh, okay.
You and I are in a very similar place right now with Twitter. When I read that, that's basically exactly how I feel about it. The costs and the benefits were pretty much exactly the same for a long time, and now it's just increasingly toxic and just, it has changed. In 2013, it was fun.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was already, So, I mean, the retweet, so it began getting worse. But you're right. When I joined it in 2012, 2011, and yeah, it was not nasty. 2014 is when sort of this phase change, the phase change happened. But, you know, if you could put yourself back, suppose you could go back to the year 2000 or even in 2007, and someone said to you, hey, there's this thing that you can do if you want, and it's free, and it'll take up about 15 to 20 hours a week of your time, and it'll probably be bad for your mental health, and you won't really benefit. Well, you'll learn stuff. You will be exposed to stuff, but it'll take up 15 hours a week of your life. Mm-hmm. Would you do it? And, you know, unless you're sitting around on a sofa all day long, you're saying, my God, 15 hours a week? No, that would be horrible. I can't spare that. But it's a gigantic time suck that is not neutral. It actually greatly ramps up hostility and distrust. And so to come back to critical theory, Martin Gurry has this book, The Revolt of the Publics, in which he points out that social media is really good at tearing things down, but it's not good at building things up.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you can have, you know, everybody donate to tsunami relief. You can have things like that. But you don't really build up institutions, but it's great at destroying things, or actually at making the leaders of things destroy themselves because they overreact to, you know, 100 tweets over one day.
Right.
And if they would just wait a week, the auto de fe will move on elsewhere.
It's just, I watch everybody's mental health disintegrating. So to go back and give credit to the man who came up with this online disinhibition effect.
Okay.
And his name is John Suhler. And he wrote The Psychology of the Digital Age. And it's fascinating.
Oh, I don't know that.
Great read. He was way ahead of this kind of process of siloing who you are online versus privately.
Okay.
And it's really fascinating. But I do find that, you know, I was talking to somebody in a podcast the other day, and I just don't necessarily know that I like who I am all the time when I'm online. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I'll see it, because you do become this flattened parody of yourself.
Right,
and
that's right.
It is a time suck for me. I should have written two books in the last 6 years, and I can't get one out. I'm like you. There's absolutely no excuse for it, and I can really point to Twitter as sucking so much of that time.
That's right.
I'm worried about it. I constantly say this. I said this last week on my final little outro and my dumpster fire. Because I checked out and went to Joshua Tree, and I just didn't care. I didn't care about anything. Mm-hmm. And it's so important. I was with my best friend, and we ate good food, and we were present with each other, and we went hiking, and we had no service, and I didn't care. And it was when all that news was breaking and everything, and the trial was coming, the Chauvin trial was ending, and people were texting me, and I just was like, I don't.
Yeah.
And it felt really healthy. I felt mentally and physically better than I have felt in those 4 days in a while. And I think I'm worried about people. I'm worried about their mental health.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about that, because in writing The Coddling of the American Mind, Greg Lukianoff and I have been really tracking this, what's happening, because a lot of this is that Gen Z showed up on campus in 2013, and that's when Greg started noticing this stuff. And I'm not blaming them. I mean, the whole book is about how good intentions and bad ideas are what set them up for extraordinary rates of depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But the construct I'm using to open all my talks nowadays is, well, I'll just try it out here. What's the most fundamental question in life? Just tell me a question. What do you think is the most fundamental question in life?
What is the meaning of it?
Okay, you're wrong. That is not a fundamental question. That's a big question, but that can't be a fundamental question. Fundamental means like the foundation on which everything else is built.
Mm.
And so I submit that the fundamental question in life is approach versus avoid. That's it.
Okay.
Because as soon as life appeared on Earth and was able to move, the first bacteria with a tail, now you have to have some mechanism for deciding which way do I move. Do I move towards this thing or away from it? And then the entire history, a billion years of brain evolution is just a variation on that. How can we make a brain that's better and better and better? So a fish brain has all this sensory stuff that it can decide, approach or avoid.
Mm.
And by the time you get to a human brain or any mammal brain, you have a vast portion of the front left cortex is the behavioral activation system. It's for approach. A lot of emotions make us good at seizing opportunities, creating value with others, cooperating. And then the front right cortex is really specialized for withdrawal, for fear. And fear circuits, disgust is a little deeper in. But so our brains, we can quickly switch. We can either be in explore mode when the front left is activated, or we can be in defend mode when there are threats and the sympathetic nervous system is activated. And in life, unless you're actually in a war zone, in life, you should be in explore mode almost all the time, except
right.
when you're really under a real threat. And the tragedy of college since 2014 is that American colleges, which, American universities are the best in the world. They were for a long time, at least. I think they still are, I suppose. But it was in part this residential experience that we developed, modeled on Oxford and Cambridge, but even better. And, many of us look back on our college years. It was just great fun. And I felt like a kid in a candy shop. I couldn't wait for the course catalog to come out. Because, I can just, attend a lecture on Chinese art by the world's greatest. Wow. Oh, but that's the same time as this other. It was like kid in a candy shop, total
right.
behavioral activation system. And that's how you learn. That's how you grow.
Right.
You only grow when you're in the BAS mode, not in explore mode, not defend mode. But what happened in 2013 is all of a sudden, we had a wave of freshmen coming in with very high levels of anxiety and depression. And it was especially the girls, young women. Young men also are more anxious and depressed, but the young women, the stats are extraordinary. It used to be about 12%. Now it's over 30% of college women say they qualify as depression. And that's actually qualified by politics. And we'll get back to this, but it's especially young liberal white women. For them, it's a majority actually say that they have been told they have a mental disorder. So there's something about... there's something about left-wing or woke politics, the belief that everything is bad, everything is structural. I will be paid 78 cents compared to the guy next to me doing the same job for the same hours, which, of course, is false. But if you tell women that over and over again, that everything is stacked against them, everything is patriarchy and hegemony, it's like, despite the extraordinary change decade after decade in my life for women, if women on the left believe this, well, yeah, they're in defend mode all the time.
Right.
And it's tragic. It's tragic.
No, it's
because
so
they should
tragic.
Be seizing opportunities.
It's never been a better time to be a woman ever in the history
yeah,
of
or
women.
Or LGBT. Yeah,
it's
right.
crazy to me. And it's that the reason that I think one of the things that not pushed me center, but I was raised very liberal, and I'm grateful that now looking at a lot of my peers, I didn't make it through college for many reasons. And because I got addicted to drugs and I had all these things, but victimhood or the cards are stacked, that leads nowhere. Believed that, I would not be sitting here having a conversation with you.
Yeah.
I had to build my own self-esteem. I had to build myself up and realize that the opportunities were limitless. The world is kind of my oyster and take the responsibility for making something. I remember sitting in rehab at age 19 And I had a lot of reasons to feel like I was a victim. There were things that were completely out of my control that probably led to me ending up in that rehab center. But I sat there and I recognized it didn't matter. I still had to build a life.
I still
had to put one foot in front of the other. It did not, that I can process that stuff. It's important to deal with that. But at the end of the day, it couldn't define me. And I had to keep believing in a better world. And, you know, when you were talking about avoid and approach, I think a lot about the work that my therapist and I have spent the last 7 years doing, particularly since I got sober from everything. And I was in survival mode for so long, just creating my own problems and also living out things that I had never dealt with. And she said, we have to, you know, figure out how to go from survive to thrive.
That's the whole process.
Yep. And I see so many people just, they're being put psychologically in survival mode when it's not even necessarily true, but they're offering no way out.
That's right. That's exactly right. If there was some, you know, super villain misogynist who wanted to harm women, you know, a good way would be to promote these beliefs in eternal victimhood. That would be a very good way to prevent them from being successful.
This is my stand-up routine, patriarchy so crafty.
Yeah, and the same, we do the same thing for, you know, for the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, if they wanted to harm African Americans and reduce their success, they would buy a million copies of Ibram Kendi's book and Robin DiAngelo's book, and they would tell every institution, you know, accept the victimhood narrative, and they would tell everyone, accept the victimhood narrative, and then, you know, you can feel righteous, and but you will not get ahead. Our book, Greg originally wanted to call it Disempowered, because that's the point of this. If you believe these three great untruths, you will be disempowered. You will be a weak force in this world, and you will be miserable. Now, as a marketing tool, the publishers at Penguin Press were right that The Coddling of the American Mind is a better title than Disempowered. But yeah, it's all about disempowerment versus empowerment.
And so how do you, this is, I think, one of the reasons that I worry is that hopelessness, and I see this in lots of young people who write me, like you said, particularly women, if the whole world or their whole world is telling them men are evil, society is bad, you're never going to get ahead. These studies that are coming out are crazy. Have you seen these things where it's like white liberals are the only people who hate their own race?
Right.
You know, they hate themselves. They're basically being taught to this self-loathing that is so deeply ingrained. And then it's incentivized and monetized because now we have this kind of victimhood economy.
Right.
What I've been really wrestling with as somebody who has pulled myself out of that mentality just because I had to, how do I help people? What is the path forward? And how do you break through all of this noise? Or do you just hope that, you know, I was like, eventually everyone's going to need a 12-step program of their own.
Yeah. Well, so it's vital that we break this, these processes that are damaging all, you know, Gen Z. I presume you're a millennial. I don't know what year
you
were born.
I'm actually Gen. I'm a Gen. I'm 78, so I'm Gen X.
Okay.
I'm a little bit older.
Okay. Well. All right. Well, you look great for.
Thank you for
Gen X. So Gen X and the millennials, you know, they have slightly higher rates of depression than previous generations. But that's been a long historical process over many decades. There's this hockey stick. You know, the rates just shoot up right around 2012 to 2014. Mm. And so we've got to break that cycle because this is likely to stay with people for life as their brains are developing at puberty. It's a very plastic time. It's a time when neurons will get set and patterns more. So we have to, I think, especially focusing on elementary schools and middle schools, elementary schools, kids have to have a lot more time playing unsupervised. This is, it's the combination of social media that Gen Z got in middle school, whereas the millennials didn't get it until they were in college or later. And they're doing okay in terms of mental health. So it's getting social media in middle school, and possibly even bigger is the loss of vast amounts of unsupervised free play when kids learn to work out conflicts on their own without appealing to an adult. What we've done, because of our fear of abduction, we've kept them always supervised, and because of our fear of bullying, we always have someone there to resolve disputes, and we tell them, you know, go if you see something, say something, go to an adult. And so kids get very, very practiced in how to make their case in the most powerful way to win with the adult.
Mm.
And that's what this wave of kids did beginning in 2013. It wasn't just that they found everything threatening. You know, like a speaker, you know, like Maya Leonopoulos is going to come to campus, invited by the College Republicans. Okay, whatever you think of him, you don't have to go to the talk.
Right.
So it's not damaging or dangerous. But we were so puzzled that students were acting like a visiting speaker that they don't have to attend is dangerous and damaging and must be stopped. They were basically in defend mode. They saw everything as dangerous. So we've got to break that cycle. And I just had an idea yesterday. I had a kind of an aha when I was thinking, because I read Stoic wisdom every morning,
yep.
I read, especially Marcus Aurelius,
yep.
Epictetus. They're fantastic, and Buddha, also the Dhammapada.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I wrote my first book was called The Happiness Hypothesis: Finding mm-hmm. Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom. And the ancients, it's not that they were smarter than us, but the ideas of theirs that come down to us are like quadruple filtered, so that only the very best ideas ever thought come down to us. And there, I think everyone should read the Stoics before they get on Twitter. And if they read the Stoics, they would actually get off of Twitter. But I was reading them, I was thinking, wow, you know, young people, Gen Z really needs to be exposed to this. And I was realizing, I'm giving talks these days on what I'm calling wisdom deprivation disorder. That is, to the extent that the things coming into your eyes and ears, you know, what percentage of them were created in the last week? What percent were created in the last year? What percent were created before the year 2000?
Right.
What percent were created before the year 1900? And, you know, whatever it was 100 years ago, it's very different now. When I was a kid, a lot, you know, we watched too much TV, but TV was created by people older than us.
Right.
And sometimes we were watching TV shows from the 30s, like The Little Rascals.
Mm-hmm.
So we were connected to older stuff more than a week old and mm-hmm. even more than a year old. But now, you know, Gen Z has never had the opportunity to be connected to previous generations. They mm-hmm. may be the first generation in human history to be almost completely cut off from all of the wisdom accumulated by previous generations. And that makes them vulnerable to faddish but erroneous and self-harming ideas.
Right.
Such as, to quote from The Coddling of the American Mind, idea number one, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker.
Right.
Idea number two, always trust your feelings. And bad idea number three, life is a battle between good people and evil people. So I think Gen Z really has been force-fed these really bad ideas. It's disempowering. It's depressogenic. So I was thinking, okay, we need to somehow make a course available for people who want to unplug and do things differently. And I might turn this into a book if I can finish my current book.
Are you allowed to talk about what your current book is about?
Yeah, my current book is on capitalism and moral psychology. The working title is Three Stories About Capitalism, The Moral Psychology of Economic Life.
Oh.
And it basically picks up where The Righteous Mind left off. The Righteous Mind was about why we're so divided by social issues. This would be about why we're so divided by economic issues. And it would then go through what do we mean by fairness, inequality, ownership, dignity, give you a moral vocabulary for discussing economic issues, and then point the way towards a better form of capitalism with a third story, a third narrative, and a third metaphor.
That sounds fascinating.
So that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And it's a good time to do that because with the Biden administration, you know, they really are questioning all the old assumptions. Things really are up for grabs. It's an exciting time to be thinking about economic issues.
Do you talk about reparations in it?
I haven't decided if I'm going to talk about that. I probably will address the need to, I think we have an urgent need to increase Black wealth.
Mm-hmm.
There is, now there's a shifting of attention from not just the wage disparities, but the huge disparity in household wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because a lot of that disparity comes from the white middle class owning homes in the 20th century
right. And
home values skyrocketed. So, you know, I think the question of calling it reparations is, I think, could do more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what to say about reparations per se. But I think it is urgent to find public policies that will help African-American families greatly increase their household wealth.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
that, I think, is one of the... It's urgent to do. It would have huge effects because living with the stress of always being on the edge financially makes you less able to compete in the job market and all
to
sorts
thrive.
Of things. Yeah. So
yeah.
I think, yeah. So actually, yeah. So my book actually will address it. Yeah. So I'm sympathetic to the... I'm very sympathetic to the goal of it,
yeah.
I should say.
And so the book you were talking about that you might be writing as a course, which I want you to write this. I feel we need it so badly in society, just something to help. Because I think that my hopefulness comes from the idea that, and it's unfortunate, but I think people are going to hit rock bottoms, you know, their own emotional rock bottoms, mm-hmm. even if they're not rock bottom, like you mm-hmm. do in addiction, it will be a similar process of that where you are at that point of kind of no return or your depression, or you know something needs to change when you're open to change and mm-hmm. willingness is there to maybe have a new idea mm-hmm. or view the world a different way or just create different habits, which might improve your life.
Yeah, but society is not like a person. So you're narrating it as though a person hit rock bottom and then that person decided to change. I think we might have a similar process, but it would be because society is to some extent a market. And just as people are fleeing cities where all the schools are woke because woke education is really bad for kids. So in the same way, there are now initiatives that I've heard of to create totally alternative kinds of schooling and totally alternative kinds of university that will not be freighted with the various woke departments and the various woke policies. So I think we'd hit rock bottom as a society when we realize the extraordinary rates of depression, especially in young women, and when we recognize that this is an incredibly serious epidemic, and then parents will be looking for alternatives, and then people will provide those alternatives. And there's all kinds of really interesting financial structures to do it that make it ultimately even free in some cases.
Right. And I mean, what my fear is, like I said, I'm worried about people. My fear is that we're going to have individuals hitting rock bottom emotionally from this culture they're living in. And they're going to kind of be stumbling out of this. And there isn't like a 12-step program for just this.
Well, funny you should say that, because the book that I thought yesterday morning that I thought, oh, I should write this book. So let me test the title. Here's the working title would be Smarter, Stronger, Happier, How to Flourish in Our Age of Anxiety, Social Media, and Conflict.
Mm.
And it would be basically, any thoughtful 16-year-old or older could buy this book, or maybe I just make it free online, or at least the early versions would be free online. And the phases are so far as, step one is diagnose yourself and understand where you are and what your personality is, what your strengths are. Step two is change your river of inputs. And this is where you must disconnect from social media. I mean, you can use it, occasionally, but you can't be doing it for an hour a day. I got this from reading the Stoics, because the Stoics are amazing on this. Like, here's Marcus Aurelius. The things you think about determine the quality of your mind.
Yep.
Your soul takes on the color of your thoughts.
Yep.
Buddha says almost the exact same thing.
Yeah, as you think, so the world is. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And I have so many better quotes than that. Step three is to get stronger. And the book, The Stoic Challenge, is really good. Oh, shoot, what's the author's name? But if you just Google
it. I think I have it, actually.
Yeah.
I love the Stoics.
It teaches you how to use challenges in your life and setbacks to make yourself stronger. In fact, so I just started seeing a therapist recently, and he said a midlife crisis is not, it should be seen not as a midlife crisis, it should be seen as a midlife opportunity.
Yeah, my therapist calls it a midlife awakening.
So it's how to expose yourself to challenges, because what doesn't kill you actually usually makes you stronger, with mm-hmm. some exceptions. So step three is get stronger, and step four is get smarter. And you do that by specifically seeking out people who think differently from you. And that's where Heterodox Academy comes in, and John Stuart Mill.
Mm-hmm.
Because, if you approach your education as I'm going to fight and I'm going to decolonize things and I'm going to fight fascism and racism, if that's the way you think about your college education, you're not going to get anything out of it. But if you think about it as, like John Stuart Mill, and how, all the amazing quotes from, so we have this book, this is audio only, but we have this book at Heterodox Academy we produce called All Minus One, the second chapter of John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, beautifully illustrated and reduced by 50%. So Mill is all about how, as individuals, we're flawed, and his most famous quote from the book is, "He who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that."
Wow.
And so if you look on others as a way to make you smarter, and people who challenge you and criticize you even as a way to make you smarter, well, you'll get smarter. Yep. And then step five is get better at relationships, because Gen Z is really stunted because of what we did to them. They don't even have a chance in between classes. They don't have a chance really to talk to each other, because in between classes, they're all in their phones.
When you say what we did to them, what do you specifically mean?
Primarily the vast overprotection, depriving mm-hmm. them of the most important thing that any child needs, which is unstructured free play. Mm-hmm. All mammals play. We must play to develop our brains. And we said in the 1990s, no more play because you have to do violin practice and learn Mandarin, or because I can't let you outside because you'll be abducted, even though, you know, nobody's abducted except by the non-custodial parents, like 100 right. a year in the United States that are not by a relative or something like that. Anyway, so I think there is a program that individuals could follow, although it's hard for individuals. But if, you know, my hope is that, be it parents groups or schools, would adopt this program and focus not on decolonizing and deconstructing, but on actually strengthening and making them wiser.
I talk a lot about this in our, like, our little fetishy community, my gated community online that I have, where I think people are going to start retreating from the public space and into these little gated communities. And mm-hmm. one of my principles or things is, like, let's spend more time talking about what we're for instead of what we're against, because mm-hmm. I think it's really easy yeah. to talk about, to react and to talk about what we're against, but
yeah.
what are we building? What are we creating? And, mm-hmm. you know, that's I right. think the creative impulse of humans, I just gave this talk at, it was like World Creativity and Innovation Week. And I think it's one of the things we do right. You know, we mm-hmm. there's a lot that we don't get right, but just that impulse to create and at music and at a symphony yeah. or a building that's beautiful, or these are the things that I find just even science, how we've pretty much solved the ear. You know, we don't talk enough about how we little babies who are born deaf now can have a little implant yeah, and hear. Yeah. Like, that is a miracle that we are living to see.
But now you're shutting down the deaf community. You're wiping them out. That's now a bad thing, some of them say.
Yeah. And this is, it's a weird, I was saying this on a podcast that in many ways, I've said this a couple times, just I feel like America is almost like a trust fund baby that is mm-hmm. yeah, self-destructing spoiled rat. In yeah. order to give itself meaning. Like, to, I feel like everyone yeah. needs that hero's journey, and we have it so good. We're just...
Yeah. Yeah. There's something to that.
Because the generation that's the most depressed, they have... I was laughing because the other day millennials and Gen Z were on Twitter and they were all complaining because Postmates is having some issues mm-hmm. and they cannot function. I'm like, inject this into my veins. These yeah. kids can't cook right. or right. or survive without Postmates. It's hilarious mm-hmm. to me.
Yeah.
But there's a resilience problem. And
That's right. It's more than resilience. So Nassim Taleb, who coined the term anti-fragile, created it specifically to contrast with resilience. Because if you're resilient, then when something bad happens to you, you don't break. But what you really want is, since we're naturally anti-fragile, that is, when something bad happens, we overcome it, and then we're stronger. And it's, you know, a really important psychological idea here is that the human brain is expecting stress. We need stress. What we need is short-term stress, lots of short-term stress when we're growing up. What we don't need is chronic long-term stress. And so if you live on Instagram, if you live on social media, and you're thinking about it all the time, then you are giving yourself chronic stress and exposure to chronic stress hormones. And I think this is why we see the sex difference. Mm. Because the boys, with teen boys, I mean, they're all on their phones all the time. They're all on screens all the time. But the boys are doing a lot of video games. And
right.
video games are actually they're not harmful. I mean, they're, you know, if you're on 12 hours a day, it pushes out other things, but it doesn't cause depression.
Right.
And, you know, my son plays games. It's the only way he can really talk with friends.
Yep.
It's fun. And when the game's over, it's over.
Yep.
He's not kicking himself. Oh, God, I should have taken that shot at, you know, Whereas on social media, I think the girls are always thinking about it and they're always looking at the counters. So I think what we've done is we've protected our children from short-term stress. We try to have them, you know, nothing bad happen to them. But then at too young an age, we let them get into this, you know, outrage and rating platform that exposes the girls, especially to chronic stress. So we've gotten it exactly backwards. And I think that's why young women, especially young white women, African-Americans have lower rates of depression. And for them, there's no correlation with politics.
Why is that? Why do they think that is?
Well, for one thing, if you're a black teen on the left, you may have plenty to be angry about, but you don't have like the self-loathing and the complexity that white women have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, young white men are, and I hear this over and over again, you know, like, yeah, we know we're the bad guys. Everyone hates us. We're the cause of all the problems. And so in some sense, it might actually be toughening them.
Right.
You know, it's almost better to be called an oppressor than called a victim. If you identify, and I don't think they identify as oppressors, but they push back on it. They don't believe it, although it does make them ripe for recruitment by neo-Nazis.
Right.
Who say, you know, okay, they tell you you must have a racial identity. Oh, but your racial identity is the bad one.
Right.
Come here and we'll tell you it's the good one. You
right.
know, so once again, you know, woke policies generally just do the exact opposite of what they're supposed to do. So that would be happening to the boys, but it's really the white girls are the ones who are caught in this, you know, I'm bad, our race is bad, how can I be a better ally?
Yeah.
So yeah, this is really doing a number on white girls.
Do you see the media's influences bleeding into the judicial system?
How so?
Just the wokeness and the kind of casual illiberalism, I can't say that word, that you kind of see around in the wokeness, and do you see it affecting due process and
not yet, no. Okay. I don't. But what you have to see is that, so it's not all because Gen Z arrives someplace, but that's a big part of it. So what you have to see is that this all broke out in the universities in 2013, 2014, which is when Gen Z arrived.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't in the corporate world. I mean, there was, you know, there was some woke signal, but there wasn't wokeness in the corporate world in 2015, 2016. Gen Z begins to graduate in 2018, and that's around when it floods into the corporate world. And again, it's not just them, it's also Trump and then signaling against Trump by older people. But I've been tracking this very closely. And it's only in the last 2 or 3 years that this has come into law schools and medical schools. So they've always leaned left. But now that they have woke Gen Z graduate students, now they have things like, you know, we have to take down all the portraits of the right. scientists on the wall because they're all white men. And how can you expect a woman or an African-American to be successful when there are photos of white men around?
Right.
You know, you have to see yourself, you know, in them. So the wokeness is in medical schools and law schools, but as yet, there are no Gen Z doctors or lawyers.
Right.
But in the next 2 or 3 years, there will be. So I don't think it's affected the judicial system at all yet, but it will, as the lawyers become woke. Now, there are some woke lawyers, because it's not just a Gen Z thing. I think there are also a lot of millennials, especially progressive white women, who are woke in the millennial generation. And so, yeah, so it's probably there to some extent, but I don't think it's affected it much yet.
And one of the questions from my community that was really another one of the questions that I thought was really interesting is, I'm curious to hear his take on how parents and children being home together more over the past year might have impacted the culture of safetyism and or how he sees anti-fragility in a post-COVID world.
Yeah, I think we don't know yet.
Okay.
I think the results are going to be complicated because for some kids, it was a hardship that they overcame and they had to be inventive. And so I work with Lenore Scanese, who wrote Free Range Kids, and she's the president of Let Grow. If there are any parents out there, please go to letgrow.org. Lots of great advice for how to help your kids become stronger.
Oh, cool. Most of my audience has kids.
Okay, great. So I think some kids are going to come through this stronger. But overall, we know that the rates of depression are rising for everyone at all age groups.
Mm-hmm.
It's been tough. It's been really tough. And of course, it differs by class. You know, a lot of wealthy people here in Manhattan, they just went to their houses in the Hamptons. The kids run on the beach. You know, for them, COVID hasn't been bad. And,
right.
you know, for lower economic groups in New York City, it's been really, really hard. One of the features that I'm really upset about, because it was totally unnecessary, is the contamination sensitivity. So when this thing came out, we didn't know what it was. And we were all told, wash your hands for 20 minutes, sing happy birthday, don't touch your face, don't touch anything.
Wipe down your groceries.
Yeah, wipe down your groceries. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's fine. We didn't know, you know.
Right.
But by April, people were beginning to see, oh, no, this is an entirely respiratory disease.
Right.
And by April, it was clear there were no cases of somebody who had caught it from touch. None.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody could identify a case.
Mm-hmm.
So in April, the CDC should have said, you know what? You don't have to worry about touch. You don't have to
yeah.
spray things. This is a respiratory thing. Wear masks, everyone. We were wrong at the beginning, but now we figured out. Wear
right.
masks, but stop spraying. And they never did that.
Right.
Last week, they finally made an announcement. But even then, they couldn't give businesses an all-clear signal and say, you don't have to spray. They did. So all over New York, people are still wasting time and money spraying.
Right.
All they said is, it's lower risk.
Right.
Okay, so think about it. You have a generation that's already at much higher levels of anxiety and depression.
I know.
They're already running the front left cortex of their brain much more than any previous generation. And now they've had 15 months of being told, everything's contaminated. Don't touch. People are contaminated. Don't touch. If they touched it, you don't touch. And this is at the beginning of puberty.
Right.
This is when they're just beginning to think about dating. And we program them in that everyone is dangerous.
Yeah.
So I think the long-term effects of COVID are likely to be a big acceleration of depression in both boys and girls.
Interesting. I'm worried. The thing I worry about is I saw this. They're estimating. I'm not sure how true it is. And maybe you have more information on this about all of the kids that never logged in. You know, they're saying
yeah,
3 million yeah. kids is the estimate, never even
yeah.
logged in. And they're
yeah,
just this last
right.
generation.
For, yeah, for all the talk about equity, for all
yeah.
the talk about equity and how, you know, the financial the difference and how working class and African American
yep.
communities are suffering, for all the talk, the goddamn teachers union wouldn't let the teachers go back to work, even after they're vaccinated.
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, the effects of the closed schools on kids, especially poor kids, African American
yep.
kids, is devastating
I've been
and is likely
this.
To leave an echo for the rest of their lives.
Oh, for the rest of their, I mean, if, in some cases, they, particularly if they were 16, 17, juniors, sophomores, I know that there was one, somebody was telling me recently about one, he was a principal or something, and he went and looked for all the kids, and it was like, the stories are just heartbreaking.
Oh,
it's
man.
Somebody's dad died, and he had to take care of the kids, and how, I mean, I know that if that had happened to me with the upbringing that I grew up in, there was no way anyone was making sure I was logging in
right
to
right.
to pajama school, you know, that
yeah.
that just
that's
wasn't
right. And how are you going to get a laptop and how are you going to get an internet connection?
Yeah. And
so it's,
what if both
yeah.
your parents, people, the safetyism
yeah.
is so weird to me. My husband works in a grocery store. And so we were never really crazy about this stuff because he was working with the public from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see, I see people online and they're like getting, crying when they're getting their vaccines. I can leave my house now. I'm like, you
yeah.
know, people have been working this whole time, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
The nannies
yeah.
and the gardeners and
yep.
like, they never stopped
yeah.
working and ever.
That's right.
It's
yeah.
just weird to me.
No,
for all
right.
this
somebody,
talk about equity, I
yeah,
don't
exactly.
understand.
Yeah. Somebody tweeted a few months ago, somebody tweeted, teachers are frontline workers. It's about time they started acting like it.
Yeah.
Now, look, most of the teachers are great. And I, you know, I love teachers and the ones I know are wonderful.
They are.
It's the union.
It's the
teachers
union.
Union.
Yeah.
The teachers union, I think, comes out of this looking really bad. And I hope this breaks the teachers union in a lot of places. Because
yep.
I think they're just a force. They don't care about the kids. They care only about protecting. It's not even all the teachers. It's the older members. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Corey DeAngelis has a lot to say about this. He writes about school choice, and he was saying the same thing. It's not the teachers, it's just that they've been incentivized in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So it's more just the unions incentivize the wrong things.
Yeah,
and
that's right. And I heard my colleague here at NYU, Scott Galloway, who's this just really brilliant commentator on the nexus between economic and social and technological events. He said, this is going to hurt the whole union movement, that unions come out of this looking really bad. Because
mm-hmm.
the teachers union, especially, the police union also, we all got to look into that with George Floyd and all the other things
mm-hmm.
that, you know, it's the police union is what prevents the most reasonable changes to policing.
Yep.
Amazon workers rejected the union down there.
Mm-hmm.
In Alabama. So, you know, and this is something I'll be covering in my new book. You have to have some balance of power between labor and capital. And, you know, the employees can't have all the power to get all the surplus created by a worker working with a company. So unions, you know, my grandparents were labor organizers, right. You know, Jewish New York Garment District. So, you know, I sympathize with the goal of a union,
yep.
But as they're actually practiced, I think what I've seen, they're mostly really bad things that just bring it, you know, because they bring in, first of all, they bring in a confrontational mindset, not a value-creating mindset, and they bring in incredible inefficiency,
mm-hmm.
In a very competitive environment. This mm-hmm. is why all these tech people work so hard to keep unions out, because if you let a union in, you know, this kind of old style union, which is going to really put, you know, it's just going to make everything very inefficient, and then you're toast, because other companies in Korea or China are much more efficient. And then, you know, and then seeing the NYU graduate students and their list of demands for their union, you know, that are mostly not even about economic matters.
Right.
So, yeah, I think Scott is right that unions come out of this, out of COVID, looking really bad.
We saw this in California with AB5. What a disaster that's been.
What was that?
So AB5 it was pretty much the unions were pushing it through this woman, a representative, Lorena Gonzalez, and it was mostly about rideshare. So they were trying to force the rideshare companies to hire their workers. Now, many people who were rideshare drivers were saying, we don't want to work. We like being independent contractors. Mm-hmm. And so it forces you to take this ABC test. And then they implemented it. And this caused a huge exodus from California pre-COVID, mm-hmm. because freelance writers now could only write 30 things a month, and
freelance writers.
It affected everybody.
God!
I'll send you the link of all the stories from people who were pushing back against this. Now, this is what PROACT is on the national level, which is why I've been screaming for years. And even when I went on Rogan both times, I was like, "Everyone vote against PROACT. This is horrible. It basically forces you to join a union or to become an employee, and it removes your ability to be an independent contractor." So
PROACT, wait, this is a national thing? What the
they're
hell is
trying
this?
To make it national.
The PROACT bill.
It's horrible. It's horrible for America. It's horrible for anyone who wants to have it basically kills the gig economy, which it did in California. And then they ended up having to write for AB5. Here's a fun rabbit hole for you to go down. They had to write so many carve outs because it hurt musicians, it hurt graphic designers, it hurt anybody who is working at an independent contractor level. And you can't hire independent contractor. It was a disaster, the whole thing. And we still have it. They still haven't repealed it. And I knew and you know who this hurt? All the marginalized people, the people who, single moms, people who are working these gigs on the side,
trying
people
to pick
who
up some extra money,
disabilities, people who have disabilities and could only work from home and were translators. Wow. Translators. Wow. I mean, it was a disaster. Yeah. And it was basically union backed. It was all.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. Right. That's an example. Yeah, that's right. Right. So in Germany, I believe there has to be a member of the union on the board of directors of the company. And the relations with unions are much more, how can we work together to make this company the best? So I need to learn a lot more about it. But I'm saying that the kind of confrontational zero-sum battle between companies and unions that we've had in this country for a long time, I think helps explain why unions are doing so poorly in this country.
Right.
And there, you know, I don't know enough about it. My guess is that there are forms of unions that have been tried elsewhere, especially in Germany, that actually would make things better.
Yeah.
So I'll have to read up on that for the book.
I think they did, you know, when worker conditions were awful and people were getting their hands chopped off and had no recourse. And
yeah, that's right. I'm sitting here in my office at NYU, exactly two blocks south of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
Oh, wow.
Where that happened in 1911. Hundreds and hundreds of you know, mostly young Jewish girls, seamstresses, were locked in when the building caught fire and they couldn't escape.
Yep. And that's when unions come in handy.
Yeah. That's right. There really was a need for them back when there wasn't even basic protections for health and safety.
I have the same two questions at the end of my podcast, and they're more about you. So what is your biggest defect of character, vice, however you want to take that at this moment?
At this moment, my biggest defect of character is that I think I've lost my sense of fun, and I used to be much more playful, And I can't tell whether it's because the world used to be much more fun and there used to be humor. And now it seems everything's so damn serious and treacherous. So I can't tell if it's the world or if it's me because I've gotten older and I've gotten so lost in my work. And so I don't play or explore very much. That's a defect of character that I'm hoping to rectify.
How are you going to rectify it? I think a lot of people feel this way.
If I can just get through this period of overwork and then I'll have time.
This is a trap.
No. I'm trying harder to honor date night with my wife. Mm-hmm. And I do play. My daughter is 11. She's still incredibly playful and we have a lot of fun together. So, and it's summer now and COVID is lifting. So yeah, we're going to try to play a lot more this summer.
Good. And what's your biggest asset?
My biggest asset? Well, I think it's that something about my personality makes me good at seeing both sides of things. And so because I studied moral psychology, and then I've said this on other podcasts, when I first did LSD in 1993 and really felt the wisdom of Buddhists and of the Buddhists and Stoics about non-judgmentalism and just seeing the world is playing out, the veil of Maya, it's what we put on it, things are happening, but it's our judgments. You know, it's not things that disturb us, but our reactions to them, that sort of thing. So I think that happened to me in 1993. And ever since then, I think I'm fairly unusual in that I really enjoy understanding all the sides of something and I don't let it drag me in emotionally. So that's what enabled me to write The Righteous Mind. And that's what enables me, I think, to study this period in which we are choking to death on moralism.
It's so true. You do know that that's what I get told that I'm a Nazi for, though, is my both sidesism.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, we'd be Nazi for anything nowadays.
That's what I love about you and respect and why I love your work and gravitate towards it. So you've been a huge influence and helping me navigate all of this as I kind of stumbled blindly into the culture wars just out of, I basically came up and was waitressing, waiting tables, just grinding in LA, trying to, sell a show, tell jokes, got a job at Playboy as a columnist. And then I was very online and I had I really stumbled blindly in 2015 into 2014, 2015 into the culture wars.
Just as it was getting nasty. Wow.
It was crazy. And so, yeah, I had never heard of internalized, the patriarchy, internalized misogyny and all this stuff. It was all new to me. So, and then it's just been a wild ride, but I've found so many amazing people in this ride and you are one of them. And I really appreciate your time. And hopefully we can talk again when you have your books coming out about capitalism. I mean, there's so many things we touched on that we could talk for an hour about, but we'll leave it here.
Yeah. We'll do it again next year. And thank you, Bridget. You are a voice not only of sanity, but of humor.
And
playfulness. And we need a lot more of that these days.
That's why I do Dumpster Fire. Honestly, every week I'm like, why am I doing this? And then I do it. And I'm like, oh, because I'm just playing in my garage.
Oh, yeah. To prepare for coming on, I watched 15 minutes of one of your Dumpster Fire things. And I was thinking, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? Is this what she's going to be like on the interview?
No.
I said, okay, I've got to be ready for this wild woman.
No, Watkins, welcome is the calm side of things.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, wonderful to meet you, Bridget.
You too.
I look forward to talking next year.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
It's time for the weekly check-in with Bridget and Cousin Maggie. Maggie and I were laughing about how delusional we still are.
Always and forever. I mean, I feel like our delusions have scaled back a little bit more and are a little bit more in line with reality.
Yeah, it's just always, I wonder at what point do you get to. We were laughing because we were saying that when our family knows what we're doing and listens to some of our content and even knows we're creating content, then we'll know we've made it.
I was saying to Bridget, I was talking to my sister today and we were just catching up. We hadn't talked in a while and she's busy. She's a mom. She's got two kids. She's just, crazy. And I was just like, oh yeah, I've been super busy lately. And she's like, oh yeah, with what? Just like trying to build a business.
Yeah, Yeah, but they think that we're just delusional idiots in their minds. Think they're like, oh, Bridget and Maggie.
Yes, because it's true. Because in our family's minds, we're just two idiots who gallivanted off to California with no plan.
And big dreams.
And a big pipe dream of someday, like, starting a business.
And that was 15 years ago. I was thinking about just the long road of creativity and how there is no real end. You keep thinking, I keep thinking, there's a there there. Mm-hmm. Oh, when our family knows we're actually doing something.
One day, one of my members of my family is going to be like, oh yeah, I listened to your podcast yesterday and here's what I think.
And, or when you make a certain amount of money or you have a certain amount of downloads. And I don't know that there ever is a there there. I was listening to Mike, he's a comedian and I'm blanking on his last name, and Bill Hader. Birbiglia, I think is how you say it. They were talking about they've known each other for years, just in New York, and when Hader was on SNL and they're friends with John Mulaney, and just their stories are like, oh, you know, Schumer and blah, blah, blah. They're just in that whole scene that came up around the same time.
Uh-huh.
And Mike was saying to Bill, oh, you won 2 Emmys for your HBO show last year, and I have a podcast. And then he also said something interesting to him where he said, oh, you're not on any of the socials. And Bill said, yeah, no. And Mike said, oh, well, not all of us can afford that luxury. And it truly is a luxury.
It truly is a luxury.
Yeah. I said this from day one on Twitter. I said, I just want to get famous enough that I don't need Twitter anymore. That is the end game for me.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's how I'll know that there's a there there.
Uh-huh.
But they were talking, and it was so striking to me to hear those two talk. Mike, who's a very successful stand-up comedian, Bill Hader, who's Bill Hader, talk, and it's still, there is still that longing and angst and frustration, and it must just be the creative frustration.
Yeah. I think entrepreneurs in particular, but people who want to be creatives and want to make shit and want to be successful at making shit, never are like, oh, okay, I'm done. I have reached the level at which I have always wanted to be. I mean, maybe Oprah.
Maybe Oprah and Ellen talking about buying all the property in between their houses.
Yeah, but still they're constantly, you know, building and expanding and tweaking and doing different iterations of content.
Yeah. It's Mike Birbiglia. I was right. Yeah, I think maybe, but even Oprah spends a lot of time developing new talent now.
Mm-hmm.
I think then that energy just goes into developing other people. But it made me realize how delusional I am, too.
Yeah.
It's a long road.
I mean,
I've been on this road for 20 years, and I am a nobody.
I don't think that you could get anywhere if you didn't have a high level of delusion when you started. And then as life kind of wears your delusions away a little bit, but still some sort of level of delusion about, you know, your own importance or what kind of success could be you can achieve or all of those things.
It's bullshit that I don't have that confidence anymore, though.
It's truly, though, it's the question of outlasting everyone else. You know, we just keep our constant catchphrase these days is just keep
going. That's always been our catchphrase.
Yeah.
That really is the mantra.
I feel like we say it to each other every time we talk.
Because there's no other way. You just keep going. And even today in our little workout that we did with the community, the Sarah Connor workouts, again, people who don't know, it's a bunch of women who get together and work out on Zoom in my subscriber community every day. So the workout today, one of the women who does the videos, she said, imagine who you could be if you just didn't stop. And I was like, it's the just keep going mantra.
Uh-huh.
If you just didn't stop, who would you be if you just kept going and got up and kept on striving? And it is, I think a lot of people just give up.
Yeah. In a lot of, I feel like they talk about this, it's common in acting or stand up or kind of the communities where you the people who find success are the ones that never stop. And they're the ones that eventually just kind of outlast everyone else.
Yeah. I see that a lot in stand-up. Mm-hmm. And some of it is just a grind. Some of it is, particularly with women, they'll just get married and have kids and go, you know, like check out. I had a friend who was saying, I'm not sure why I haven't been doing this forever. You know, a lot of women get out of it and they're like, what was I doing? And that is exactly how I'm going to feel when I get out of this racket. Tune in next week for another riveting episode that will change your life, help you get out of your own way, and solve all the world's problems. I want to thank our composer, Jared Elias, my co-producer and cousin, Maggie, and all of you out there listening. This has been Walk-Ins Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you're welcome. It's the dumbest line.